I've been preaching through the book of Proverbs, what I've called the school book of the Old Testament. So if Psalms are the hymn book of the Old Testament that we use to sing in church, then we can think of Proverbs like a school book, instructions for life. Now, the book of Proverbs in the Old Testament, again, is made up of hundreds of actual little proverbs. And then it's also got some poems at the beginning about wanting wisdom, desiring wisdom. And it has a couple poems at the end as well. So I talked about those early poems, wanting wisdom, desiring wisdom. What is it? How do we get it? That kind of thing. And now we've been going through and looking at a few big themes in Proverbs itself. So talked about emotions a couple of weeks ago. I'm going to talk about work this week. We'll see that's all types of work and tasks that we do. Talk about God a bit next week, the God of Proverbs. And then get on with some other things. Now, the book of Proverbs, of course, doesn't mention Jesus. It doesn't even portray God as a real kind of lively character like we get in other parts of the Old Testament. In a way, God feels a little bit distant. He's involved, but it's a really different kind of book than we get in the Bible. And we've got to do some work to say, what does it mean to read Proverbs, say, as a Christian, and put it within the bigger story of the Bible? So we'll do a bit of that this week as well. Work is everywhere. It's everywhere. So if we did a church field trip today, walked out to the sidewalk there, we'd see all kinds of things. We'd see another church with its own church staff probably working today. We'd see Louis Vuitton. We'd see Westpac. We'd see a news agent. We'd see Gucci. We'd see BHP and the Grand Hyatt. We'd see a lot of people at work. We also might see a lot of people shopping, it seems, or doing something with their money in Melbourne. Today, people feel overworked. They feel underpaid. Some people are accused of not working enough. There's a work-from-home debate. There's unemployment. People are having career crises. In the news this week, the New South Wales government told its public servants, you've got to come back to the office. No more working from home for the public sector employees. Victoria, state of Victoria, apparently also put out their own press release and said, hey, we're okay with work from home. We're flexible here. So come on down, work in our public sector and join us here. Work is certainly newsworthy. And let me be clear really early on, by work, I don't mean, and Proverbs doesn't mean, just job contracts and careers. That's not what I'm referring to when I'm referring to work. Well, I am referring to that, but I'm also referring to a lot of other things. I mean toil, labor, the stuff of life, the stuff that we have to do to make life livable. Everyone works. Everyone works for certain reasons as well, to influence things, for satisfaction. We work for money. We work for survival. We work to avoid being destitute, to feed ourselves, and to avoid boredom, some of us. And that's what I mean by work. I mean the toil of life. That's the way to think about it. Now, that little description of work didn't just come off the top of my head. That's the way Proverbs describes work. It talks about all those things. And this book really fits our experience, ancient experiences, 3,000 years old, give or take. Ancient experiences and modern experiences, there's no doubt about it. And one of its most frequent topics, one of the things that you'll come across the most in Proverbs, is the theme of work. Working too much, being lazy, being diligent, working to get rich, avoiding work because you're distracted by other things. It's all there. Proverbs is going to show us how work goes wrong. It's going to show us how work goes right. What's remarkable, though, is that Proverbs doesn't give us a do-better work ethic, or it's not just that. So it doesn't just say, listen, there are lazy people around, so you should feel guilty about that and work harder, or you're overworking, so relax, find some time for rest. It's going to give some advice like that, it will, but it's not just that, because at the core of good work, at the core of going about our toil in a way that's productive, satisfying, sustainable, we have to realize that work is spiritual. The things that we do are spiritual. They matter to God. God is involved with all of those things. And again, this stuff applies to the unemployed, retired, career-oriented people, people in the home, people outside of the home. Work is a spiritual thing. And by work being a spiritual thing, what I mean is three things, actually. Three things we're going to see. One is that God works. He is a worker. That we work for God. We're his stewards. And that our work belongs to God. So God is a worker. We work for God. And our work belongs to God. That's what it means for work to be spiritual. And that's why there's hope. There's even meaning for our tasks, daily tasks today. So have a look at our first proverb. I'm going to be using the sheet tonight. I've got some slides, but I think I'll just do this. Actually, I kind of like pointing down to the handout. So if you don't have one of these, feel free to, don't be afraid to stand up and get what you need. Most of the passages are on here. A slack hand causes, this is Proverbs 10, a slack hand causes poverty, but the hand of the diligent makes rich. He who gathers in summer is a prudent son, but he who sleeps in harvest is a son who brings shame. One way that work goes wrong is that we don't do enough of it. The son here is the literal lazy boy. A slack hand causes poverty. And he brings shame on his family. Lazy boy. Some of you will know the lazy boy recliner chairs. Apparently they debuted in 1927, thanks to two hardworking cousins in Detroit. They made the first reclining chair. Apparently no one had done that before. I was shocked to find this out. You either have a kind of lounge chair or you have an upright chair, but nobody had done something to make those two things possible in the way that these guys had. They called it, this is great, they called it nature's way of relaxing. But that wasn't the huge success. The 1930s, 1940s, that wasn't really the big deal for them. What paid off, really, is when 1961 came around and they made what was called the rocker recliner, or the recliner rocker, whichever one you like. And I take this as a real testament to Americans who don't simply want to relax, but they want to work a little bit while they relax, and they'd like to rock, not just recline. The lazy boy in Proverbs, who naps in his recliner rocker during harvest time, he's not just relaxed, he is actually a fool. That's what he's called. He's not wise. And we're told that he even brings shame upon his family. Now, this proverb in chapter 10 is part of a cluster of proverbs, what I call a cluster of proverbs. Other people use this term too. It's basically a mini collection. So when you read through Proverbs, you got a chapter of Proverbs. It has 30 proverbs there. You're going to see 5, 6, 7, sometimes 10 proverbs that kind of, they all have something to do with the same theme. Right, and you'll see some word links, you'll see common themes. One might be a bit out of order and things like that. But I mean, by out of order, I just mean it might not clearly fit into the group. And these start to interpret each other when you read them together. And this is part of that. It's chapter 10, 1 to 5, actually, verses 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, all have something to do with these two types of children, actually. And the wise son, it turns out, is also the upright son, who knows God and works hard, and it's that person who doesn't go hungry and brings honor to his family. The same thing goes for the other son, who's lazy, doesn't seem to be upright. It's reflected in his relationship with God, and it has negative consequences for those around him. It's this kind of wonderful kind of diamond that you see all these different sides to these little scenes. That's not the only lazy character, though. We meet another lazy character in Proverbs. This is in 19, verse 24, the sluggard. The sluggard buries his hand in the dish and won't even bring it back to his mouth. The sluggard orders pizza, just can't be bothered with getting off the couch and answering the delivery driver to get that pizza and come back to the couch. He wants bedside service, all right? It's comical. The proverb's supposed to be comical, right? It's funny. It's hardly real. Like, who's lazy enough to put their hand in the bowl and not be able to pull it back? But it ensures that we can't get away without asking the question, do I work enough? Do I work enough? That's what it is getting us to ask. And maybe you do. Maybe you do work enough. Maybe laziness really isn't your temptation. for people like that, we need to see the other side or the other perspective in Proverbs, right? And the second way that work goes wrong in Proverbs is that we work too much. And in Proverbs, we particularly work too fast, too fast. Have a look at chapter 21, verse 5. The plans of the diligent lead surely to abundance, but everyone who is hasty comes only to poverty. It's easy to kind of breeze past the first line, the plans of the diligent, right? So the diligent person is thinking through, making plans, making a good use of the time and plotting it out. But the hasty person hasn't done that. We're given the implication there. Another one, it's not on your sheet. A faithful man will abound with blessings, but whoever hastens to be rich will not go unpunished. Baking in a rush is not a good idea. If you forget one ingredient, doesn't matter what it is, eggs, baking soda, sugar, it just doesn't really turn out well, right? What was supposed to be a nice fluffy cake becomes something that you might eat for like a marathon run or something like that. And so it's really not a good idea to bake in a rush. Hasty work in the kitchen just doesn't really have good results. But that's just a cake. There are really serious things that happen when we're too fast. Buildings collapse. Life savings are lost. Relationships fail. People burn out. All in the name of getting those quick results, because we want productivity and we want it now. And we confuse that often for diligence. Have a look at another one. 24:27. Prepare your work outside. Get everything ready for yourself in the field. And after that, build your house. This is one that doesn't quite leap out into the modern world for us, right? So this is clearly couched in its ancient context. But what it's talking about is getting our priorities right, about doing first things first, about picking the right things in the right order, right? For them, that meant sorting out your field and then sorting out your house. Another one here. This one's not on the sheet either. Know well the condition of your flocks. Give attention to your herds, for riches don't last forever, and does a crown endure to all generations? Again, don't rush, but pay attention to those details. Examine your flocks, that's what it's saying. Take the time to do a task well. That's part of diligence. And however sensible and practical that advice is, the view of Proverbs isn't simply to sort your work life out. It's not simply work harder, be thorough, pick the first things first. The advice is also profoundly theological. We strive for diligence. We can strive. We should strive to be diligent people because, for several reasons, one, God himself works. God himself works. That's actually how he's introduced at the very beginning of the Bible. If you go all the way back to page one of whatever Bible you find, Genesis chapter one, we're not introduced to God by his personal name. When the Bible says the Lord instead of God, that's referring to his personal name, what is called Yahweh. We don't get his background. We don't get his attributes. We don't get his great plans and purposes or anything like that. First, we get God at work, at his creation. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. He's going to go through that process and get all the way to a point of rest. On that final day, he rests. God works in Proverbs 2, Proverbs chapter 8. If you want a bit of homework, go read Proverbs chapter 8. It's this gorgeous poem about wisdom and how God worked with wisdom at creation. It's actually from the voice of wisdom. Wisdom is personified as this woman. She calls out on the street at one point and calls to people. And then in this case, she's not particularly there, but she's talking about her involvement with God at the beginning of time. And this is what she says. When he, that is God, established the heavens, I, wisdom, was there. When he drew a circle on the face of the deep, when he made firm the skies above, when he established the fountains of the deep, when he assigned to the sea its limit so that the waters might not transgress his command, when he marked out the foundations of the earth, then I was beside him like a master workman. I was daily his delight, rejoicing before him always, rejoicing in his inhabited world and delighting in the children of man. That is really something. And it doesn't end there. If we look at Jesus and his life in the New Testament, he's working as well. In John's gospel, people are talking with Jesus about food. The religious people, they were caught up with food and its religious significance. And Jesus just says, my food is to do the will of him who sent me and to accomplish his work. Not long after that, he's working on the day that Jewish people aren't supposed to work, on the Sabbath, the day of rest, no working, all right? And Jesus is healing people on the Sabbath, which they counted as work. And he defends himself and says, my Father is working until now, and I too am working. Jesus is working, bringing restoration, bringing redemption to his Father's creation as a sign of what will be. And he's even doing that on the Sabbath when the world says, you shouldn't be doing that. God himself works. He's a worker. He created, and now he sustains the world. He's restoring creation because it's been misused and corrupted. And get this, we ourselves, human beings, are a part of God's work. This is really amazing. We're in God's job contract. He signed a job contract with creation. The Bible calls this a covenant. He's in an agreement. It's more than a contract, but he's in an agreement. And we're part of that. He's made obligations on his own terms to us. So we don't just exist to trim the hedge for God while he sips a drink by the pool. That's not the arrangement, all right? In the ancient Near East, in other stories like this, other cultures had their own stories about creation, about their gods, about their human beings. And one of the most popular ones was that the gods had gotten tired of doing stuff. And so they created creatures in order to do this labor on their behalf so they could take a nap. That's truly what was going on for the Mesopotamians, actually. And that's what they did. So when we read this, that we see God at work, that he's creating people to do things on his behalf is really remarkable. It's really remarkable in the ancient world. So we're created to witness, to watch God's work. We're created to delight in the world he's made and now to join in the act of restoring all things for his glory and joy. That, I think, is a definition of diligence, of diligence. So God just doesn't work as a kind of model for us. He commissions us to work as well. Adam and Eve, the earliest human beings, were set in the garden that God had made to work it and to keep it. They had tasks, they worked together, and they were foremost stewards of God's garden. That's the best word we have for it. Stewards of God's garden, of his creation. And that historical task, like so many things in the garden, sets the norm for what should be later on. It is not how life is now, in terms of being right, us being good stewards and having that all sort of sorted out, like they did at first. But it sets the norm for what ought to be, with God, with others, and with the world as a whole. And garden life was stewardship. Garden life was stewardship. Now, Proverbs doesn't refer to this directly, but it kind of hints at it. It hints at it. If you look at chapter 20, verse 12, the hearing ear and the seeing eye, the Lord has made them both. The Lord made the eye, the Lord made the ear, the Lord makes our hands, our heads, our feet, our brains, everything we use for our tasks has been made by the Lord. The proverb after that says, love not sleep, lest you come to poverty. Open your eyes and you will have plenty of bread. So hear it all together, the hearing ear and the seeing eye, the Lord has made them both. Don't love sleep, lest you come to poverty. Open your eyes and you'll have plenty of bread. You see where the Proverbs start to interpret each other. It's basically saying God's created you, who you are, and given you this stuff. So don't go and abuse it or misuse it, right? He's made your eyes. Open your eyes and get to it. That's the idea. We're God's stewards. We have a responsibility to use what God's given us for the way he's made us, and we shouldn't spoil it. We work for God. Again, it's stewardship. What are Olympic athletes all wearing? They're all wearing some sort of uniform, and they're wearing a flag, all right? Some of them just have a flag stamped. Some of them have a whole uniform that looks like a flag. And then some of them put a flag on after they run a race or whatever it is. Okay. And why is that? Because they represent their country. They represent their country. Now, some of them love the spotlight. Okay. We've had a bit of a strange relationship with Noah Lyles and his camera-loving personality. But when Noah Lyles wins, he still is going to put on the American flag. Yeah, because he's not running for himself. Ultimately, he's running for his country. And Olympians win for Australia, for the USA, for Jamaica, for China, for Italy, wherever they are representing. They're stewarding the gifts they've been given on behalf of something greater than themselves. They're stewarding the gifts they've been given on behalf of something greater than themselves, and in this case, a nation. That's exactly how all of God's creatures should think about life, to steward well the gifts that God has given us as his representatives. And you see, that's not why it's about career or unemployment or disabilities or working from home or being a stay-at-home parent. It's about doing whatever lies before you in a way that honors God, that loves others, and that stewards well his gifts. One way to think about it is a portion. Another book of the Bible, Ecclesiastes, talks about everyone having a lot or a portion. It's a slice of the pie, and it's your little slice of the pie. They differ greatly. And we look at other people and think, what if I had been given, for good or bad, that slice of the pie? And someone looks at you and says the same thing, right? We've all have this piece in life, and we've got to steward it. That's what we have. When you have some time, some questions worth asking. These are worth re-asking. What are the gifts of God? What are the gifts of God in my life? What's been entrusted to me? And how can I use it responsibly in a way that honors God and seeks the good of others? What have I been given? What's been entrusted to me? How can I use that to honor God and seek the good of others? Just some questions to ponder. Let me add one thing on this too, about how work goes wrong. Sometimes we toil at the wrong tasks. Another proverb says, whoever works his land will have plenty of bread, but whoever follows worthless pursuits will have plenty of poverty. Worthless pursuits are those activities that don't produce your daily bread. All right, they don't reward your time and energy. They might be good. They might even be necessary in small doses, but they're not ultimately acts of stewardship. All right? Now, there are some things that people can think of in this realm, I'm sure. People say we live in an age of distraction, but we also live in this world that Proverbs knows well and is trying to help us out with. So again, that's not just about working enough. It's about working at some of the right things. So some of us work too little. Some of us work too much. Some of us work at the wrong things. We get so preoccupied with unproductive tasks. But we can also find ourselves working for the wrong reasons. If there's any one motivation in Proverbs that threatens godly labor, I say if there's any one motivation in the whole Bible that's a real danger to working in the way that God wants us to work, it's wealth. It's wealth. Let me talk about money for a little bit. I was going to do a whole sermon on money because Proverbs has a lot to say about it. But let me just do it now a little bit. Wealth is the poster child for earthly work. I mean, it's the primary driver for those who don't see work as a spiritual thing. Proverbs says it plain as day, 23:4, right here on the sheet. Don't toil to acquire wealth. Be discerning enough to desist. Now, we have to reckon this goes hand in hand with the lazy son who comes to what? Poverty, all right? And that's not meant to be a good thing. And other proverbs where it's going to say the diligent person abounds in riches or something like that, okay? But Proverbs is also going to give us a bit of a scare and say, be careful when that becomes the main thing. Jesus, again, completely backs this advice. It's a famous scene. Young rich man comes up to Jesus. He says, "Teacher, what must I do to inherit eternal life? Just tell me what I need to do." Jesus says, "Oh, you know, the commandments, you know what you need to do. Love God, love other people." And he says, "I've done that since I was a kid." And Jesus says, "What you really need to do is this. Give up everything you have and follow me. Give up everything and follow me." Those are Jesus's words. He goes on to teach that you can't serve more than one master. You can't be ultimately loyal to more than one person or more than one thing. He calls it mammon, famous word from the Bible, mammon, stuff, wealth, material things, all that gain. And wealth is such a widespread motivator, not because principally we like money. People who like money just like to arrange numbers mainly and have a quantifiable way to measure their work and what they get. Money's so great for most people because it provides security, it provides status, and it provides satisfaction. These other things that we actually really want. Proverbs is on to this as well. Proverbs 18, 10 to 11. This is one of my favorites. "The name of the Lord is a strong tower. The righteous man runs into it and is safe. A rich man's wealth is his strong city and like a high wall in his imagination." These proverbs do exactly what Jesus does. They compare God and wealth. The rich man imagines his wealth is a fortress. It's going to protect him in hard times. It'll get him out of trouble. He can sleep in there at night easily. It's secure. It's not going anywhere. It's the fortress. The U.S. dollar says, "In God we trust." But it should really say, "In money we trust." Working for wealth, again, working for wealth as the final goal of labor. Many wonderful people who God has just so happened to bless with lots of money, and it doesn't keep them from knowing Him. They do great things with that. But when it's the final thing, that's the real danger. When it's the ultimate thing, when it is getting us up in the morning, ultimately keeping us up at night, because wealth doesn't actually help you sleep that well. When that becomes the problem, when wealth is really held out as the main thing, it's the epitome of saying that my work belongs to me. I make my money on my terms, and it's under my control. I'm not answerable to God. I'm not working for God. My work doesn't belong to Him. It belongs to me. It's a complete misconception of what it means for work to be spiritual. And I'm not saying this is someone who's gotten it completely figured out. Takes us to our third point. Our work is not our own. Our work is not our own. It belongs to God. Success and failure, reputation and legacy, satisfaction and value. So much of this is in God's hands, and everyone here probably has a story about it. All those different things that we want, have gotten a taste of, have gotten a lot of and then none of, have always wanted but never really quite realized. We know it's so much of them are up to the whim, what seem to be whims and fancies of each day. And they're really largely up to God. To let go of that and think, my work belongs to God and all those things I associate with it, is freeing when we entrust our work to God. It's freeing to entrust our work to God. If that sounds difficult, and it does, then let's go right back to the scene with Jesus and the rich young man. The rich ruler actually walks away. He doesn't take Jesus up on his offer. That's too hard for him because he loves money more than God. The crowd gasps. They gasp at that response and they say, "Who then can be saved? If Jesus has just said eternal life is off the cards for this guy because he's walked away with that choice, then who can be saved?" Jesus says, "What's impossible with man is possible with God. What's impossible with man is possible with God." Learning to work well, in Proverbs, in the Bible, according to Jesus, It's not simply about doing more or trying harder. It's about becoming a different kind of person by the power of God. What we do in life, our labor, all these things, they belong ultimately to God. We also work for God. We're His stewards, His representatives on earth. And God Himself is a worker. In short, work is spiritual. Let me explain one last thing, and that's why this makes sense in the bigger story of the Bible. It's the final thing. Here's the story. God created all things, and He created human beings to carry out tasks on His behalf. Enjoy in communion with Him. That's the ideal. That's the design. That's what I called garden life. All of that went awry. It went wrong, and now life really hurts. Work, especially. So Jesus visits earth as the incarnate Son of God. He's emptied Himself of certain divine privileges, that's what we're told, emptying Himself, taking the form of a servant. His biggest task is to forgive sins, and that's what He does. He dies on the cross and forgives sins. He's doing that as part of a broader job, really, or a bigger job description. And that's the cosmic restoration of all things. I just mean everything. Everything, everywhere is getting restored by the work of Jesus Christ. And that's why He says, "My Father is working until now, and I am working." Everything is getting caught up in the work of Jesus Christ. And as I said earlier, you are part of that work. I'm a part of that work. He's working on us, which is also an invitation. An invitation, I'd even say it's really a demand. It's really a demand to join in that work. Whoever you are and wherever you find yourself. Now, I don't know exactly what that means for you today. I suspect we've got just about every conceivable situation and relationship to work and life's tasks in a room this size. Let me make some suggestions of things, possibilities. Maybe you need to search your heart and motivations, the whole question of why. Why am I doing this? I'm not prone to be lazy. I love work, but why do I work? Maybe we need to surrender something to God. Work belongs to Him. Our identity as stewards isn't quite right. Maybe you're realizing that what you've been doing all along is actually part of a bigger story than just about you. It links up with something much bigger, and your work is dignified in a new way. Maybe you've lived a lot of life. Maybe career isn't something you've even thought about in a long time. And you're looking back on life and you can help someone younger find their way who's doing nothing but looking ahead. Maybe you're younger. And maybe you can help someone older look back and think, let's look at the pieces. Let's add up because what you've done is really significant. So whatever Monday holds, know this, that God's going to give you wisdom for the task. Let me finish with a quote from James. I should have been using this in every single sermon, so I'm just going to start now. Better late than never, as the proverb says. James 1:5, if any of you lacks wisdom, let that person ask God, who gives generously to all without finding fault. If any of you lacks wisdom, that is an invitation straight in the first chapter of a New Testament book. If any of you lacks wisdom, let that person ask God for it, who gives to all without reproach, without finding fault.